Welcome back to the Avert Alzheimer's podcast. My name is Leanne and I am your host, and I am so excited for this episode. I have just been waiting for this day to be able to deliver it to you. In this episode, I am interviewing Craig Emmerich. Craig, if you're not familiar with who he is a very influential person in the keto and carnivore universe. And he is someone who I respect greatly. He and his wife, Maria, have been keto for 25 years, I believe he says in the interview, and they have created a certification program, which I have taken and become certified as a keto, carnivore, and supplement coach through them. Maria has written so many countless cookbooks and has a crazy, incredible knack for keto cooking and creating these recipes that just make changing your lifestyle and eating a healthier way, a way that will keep your brain healthy for a much longer period of time. She just has a beautiful knack for that. Craig, on the other hand, has an incredibly beautiful scientific mind, and he does so much research, and that's what we're going to tap into in this interview. We talk about keto and brain health. We talk about what he has learned in terms of how carnivore and keto can truly help the brain. But not only that, we dive into a lot of the science behind why keto works so well and how the brain and body work really well off ketones and why we don't need carbs. So I am going to shut my mouth now and let you watch this interview. I encourage you to watch it all the way through. Share it with everybody you know, and all the links to everything that we discuss in this interview will be in the description below. All right, here we go.
Well, I can't thank you enough for doing this. I mean, I got my certification through you guys, and I just am super honored that you're willing to do this. So thank you.
Of course, I'm ready to talk about anything.
I know. Well, so the interesting thing for me, and the one of the biggest reasons that I wanted to have you on, is because I just find that people are so afraid to talk about Alzheimer's. Like,
yeah,
everybody wants to lose weight, but my experience since I got certified as a keto coach is everybody wants to lose weight just long enough to lose the weight, and then they want to go back to their old way of eating. And, you know, it's either for a vacation or for, you know, whatever the case may be. Their doctor tells them they need to lose a little bit of weight. And I know you guys have so much experience with this, but for me, it's very personal, which is why my business is named Avert Alzheimer's now, because my mom died. My grandmother died from Alzheimer's. My mom is 72 and she could die any day. She's late stage Alzheimer's. And
sorry.
I carry both genetic variants for it, which now they're starting to say science is showing could actually be beneficial for people who have it. And to help prevent it, provided we eat a certain way, which is keto. So that was kind of what I wanted to talk to you about. And I've done some research around carnivore because I actually prefer to eat carnivore, but I think I should eat more keto. So I kind of, I wanted to have a little discussion with you about that. So
let's dive into it.
Okay. All right. So the first question that I had told you that I wanted to talk about was just the difference in eating for your brain health versus weight loss, because like I said, a lot of people want to do keto because they think it's like Atkins. It's the great weight loss plan, and there's so much science and data behind it. And you are such a scientific expert around like all the carnivore videos and all the keto videos. And I'm just going to go ahead and do a little plug for Keto Adapted right now. If you ever want to be a keto coach, Keto Adapted is where to get it. Craig has ridiculous knowledge around the scientific reasons that you want to follow a keto or carnivore plan, but just dive into that just a little bit about how that can benefit the brain.
Yeah. So, you know, the thing is, it's been interesting. Maria and I have been doing this for over 20 years, helping clients and people with all kinds of health issues as well as lose weight. But the thing that's over and over and over, and the thing that sticks with people, and the reason people stick with this lifestyle and don't just use it as a quick fix, you know, quick weight loss diet, is that the way they feel and the health improvements they see and getting off medications and, you know, symptoms going away for you name it condition. And that's why they stick with it. It's not the weight loss. You know, the weight loss is like an extra bonus, how good they feel. And that's the thing that's, you know, with this lifestyle is so huge, I think, is that that's why it is a lifestyle, because you don't want to go back to feeling crappy and mood swings and, you know, all these other issues, you know, brain fog and sleepy in the afternoon and, you know, all these things that you don't have when you eat properly. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, what keeps people on this lifestyle.
Yeah. I know for me personally, it cleared up all my digestive issues that I had. And that was a big deal for me. I was so grateful for it. I know when we're thinking about brain health specifically, a lot of times the higher fat keto is what people want to go toward. But I know from my own research and working with my mom. So my mom lived with us for 2 years. And in that 2 year period of time, this was from 2019 until 21. So we were in the thick of COVID when we had to put her into a memory care facility because we just couldn't socialize her anymore at that point, and she declined pretty severely. But we were able to reverse her diabetes through keto. We were able to, and this is when I dove in, this is when I found out about you guys and when I started taking your courses. And so we reversed her diabetes, we slowed the progression of her disease, and then we put her in memory care. And the memory care facility she lives in is owned by a friend of mine who's just a very dear and amazing woman, but they can't afford to have a healthier diet for them. So my mom has just, at this point now, she has declined to the point where we expect she'll die in the next few months. So diet is truly everything, especially when it comes to brain health. However, my whole purpose is prevention, right? I want to teach people early in life that if you just make that change now. So the high fat keto, and you guys talk about this a lot, fat begets fat. If you're going to eat a high fat diet and you're trying to clean your body up, you're going to hold on to it. So touch on that just a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, especially when it comes to things like diabetes and insulin resistance, you know, and to preface here, you know, many researchers now call, and we have been, Marie and I have been calling this for, I don't know, 10 years.
Yeah.
Alzheimer's is like type 3 diabetes. It's insulin resistance of the brain. It's the brain not able to fuel itself on glucose anymore because of the insulin resistance that's there. So, you know, so much of that comes back to diet, right? Like, you know, we wouldn't think of, you know, type 2 diabetes, especially what we know now, as not being able to be managed with diet. Yes, it can be managed with diet. Yes, you can improve it. And I think you can reverse it with diet. And how do you do that? Well, you got to go back to root causes. And that's what's so important to understand and think about when you think about disease process. You know, in our keto book, we put this, I made this disease tree, and it's basically this tree, right? Where and the trunk of the tree is insulin. That's kind of one of the main, and I would today add inflammation to that trunk, you know, as two primary drivers. But the leaves or the output is your disease, whether it's, you know, Alzheimer's, diabetes, cancer, all of these metabolic disorders and issues, autoimmune disorders. And the root causes, the roots of that drove that disease process are many. And nutrition is a huge one. Yes, nutrition is a huge cause, especially when you can start talking about things like diabetes. But there's others too. I mean, there's getting common sense sun exposure to get your vitamin D levels right. There's, you know, exercise. There's the negative inputs like smoking and things you want to avoid, right? So all those are inputs. And if those inputs get off, your body's going to do what it needs to do if it's given the right inputs. And it's when the inputs get off that the outputs happen, the disease happens. And so like diabetes, type 2 diabetes, it's primarily overstuffed fat cells that cause diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And what I mean by that is, you know, I heard this when I was young, and it now come back full circle for me, that when you're young, you make new fat cells, but almost everybody at a certain age will stop making new fat cells. And so when you're an adult, you don't make new fat cells. You just fill up or empty the ones you have. Okay. And that creates something called a personal fat threshold. It's a threshold of how much fat you can gain before the whole system starts to fall apart. You know, you have basically a metabolic syndrome and diabetes and all this, you know, problem that occurs because you run out of places to store fat, right? So let's say, you know, just as a real simple example, you've got one person has 10 fat cells. I mean, you have far more than this, but let's say 8 of those 10 are just stuffed to the point where they can't hold any more fat or they're just going to burst. Mm-hmm. Like there's a limit to how big they can get. So what's that fat cell do? It rejects insulin. It says, don't put any more fat in me. I'm done. I can't store anymore. Well, if 8 of those 10 are like that, and you only got 2 of these left that can take any fat, and you're eating high fat meals, where's the fat going to go? Right? It's the fat, the body's like insulin is driving up and up and up, trying to stuff it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And yet all these fat cells are like, nope, I'm rejecting you. I'm not taking any. And that's why your fasting insulin will slowly go up, and it'll go up significantly as you get close to that personal fat threshold where you got too much fat stored, not enough places to put it anymore. And insulin's rising because it's struggling to get this fat out of the blood and manage the fuel in the blood. So fat accumulates in your pancreas, it accumulates in your liver, you get fatty liver, and that's diabetes, metabolic dysfunction, you know, the whole roller coaster of type 2 diabetes. Well, what happens if you shrink those fat cells? If you shrink them, i.e. empty the fat out of them and burn it and get rid of it, now you've got place to put it again, your fasting insulin will come back down and your metabolic state will be back to a much better place, right? Well, I just said somebody with 10 fat cells, they're gonna get there really quick, right? Mm-hmm. You won't even be able to see on their body that they're overweight. You know, they'll look totally fit. And we've had women that are 105 pounds that are type 2 diabetic because they've only have so many, they don't have many fat cells and they're all stuffed. And then you can have on the other end of the spectrum, somebody with 300 pounds of body fat on their body and yet no insulin resistance, no metabolic dysfunction, right? Because they have so many fat cells that they, you know, they're still not stuffed. And so they still have places they can put it. And so it explains the spectrum of type 2 diabetes. And it also explains why somebody with diabetes pumping a bunch of fat in the diet when their fat cells are already stuffed is not a good solution. Sorry for the long-winded answer.
No, that was so good. So the one of the words that you touched on, so I created a course that's going to be released soon, and it's the 5 pillars of Alzheimer's prevention based on my own research, and fasting is one of those pillars. So you touched on the word fasting. I want to just briefly talk about that because I there's so much information out there that is for fasting and that's against fasting and intermittent fasting versus extended fasting. And I kind of do a mixture of all of it. And I do know that fasting can be very beneficial for the brain. It can be very beneficial for ketones. But I also know from my own personal experience, sometimes when I come out of those really long fasts, I'll come out of it and break it very, very wrongly. And I'll eat too much fat. And then it's just not a good thing. But so for ketosis specifically, fasting can, fasting mimicking, that's like a big buzzword right now that I'm not very familiar with. So I just kind of want to know what the Emmerich keto adapted idea is around fasting for brain health.
I would kind of table the whole fasting mimicking thing. I don't think there's a lot of great, much of anything to discover there, to be honest. But good to know. You know, when we look at it, we kind of separate things into a couple of piles. And the first one is to separate intermittent fasting from the extended fasting. And the reason is they're very different kind of situations in that how metabolically what happens to the body and what happens to your lean mass and muscle and all of these kind of things. Because, you know, intermittent fasting is great. Intermittent fasting is, you know, basically time restricted eating where you're restricting the time you're eating your food to 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, just a smaller window. And then you eat nothing outside of that and you give your body some time to rest, right? And digest and do its thing. That's good. And it comes really naturally for people eating this way. You're just not as hungry all the time. So, you know, skipping one of the meals and just eating two meals in like a 6-hour window of time just becomes easy. You know, people eating standard American diet can't imagine doing that, you know, just skipping a meal because you're hungry all the time. But, you know, when you get adapted and you get to be in this state where your hunger hormones are just under control and you don't have cravings and you don't have those spikes in hunger, it becomes easy. Mm-hmm. And it's a good tool, too, if you really kind of stick to it, especially for people that are the mindless snackers, you know, the people that, you know, sit down in front of TV and they're snacking away and they don't think about it really and don't really account for it. And you know what their daily, and that can add up really fast, especially, you know, things like nuts and, you know, high energy, you know, dense foods. Like I remember this, there's a meme of this, you know, two hands with piles of nuts in each hand. Uh-huh. And it looks like one hand has, you know, 4 or 5 more nuts in it than the other hand, but it's got twice the calories of nuts. You know, it's hard to quantify when something's that, you know, energy dense. And so you're grabbing, you know, handfuls, how much are you really getting, you know?
Yeah.
And so those kind of mindless things or those kind of snacking habits, cutting those out, because most of the time it's not hunger. It's just you're bored and your mouth, it's a Japanese word that converts to like lonely mouth, you know, because it's like you just kind of want to chew on something or, you know, so. But if weight loss is the goal and for, you know, other reasons, cutting that out is very beneficial. And so having that eating window is great. On the other side of the spectrum, the extended fasting, now we're talking about, you know, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days of eating nothing, just water.
Yep.
So for that, in general, we typically don't recommend it because, you know, every study on it has shown that you will lose muscle.
Okay.
And muscle is something that is just too important to lose. I mean, it's especially as we get older.
Yeah.
It's so hard to even maintain your muscle. There's leucine is the amino acid that's primarily responsible for starting the muscle protein synthesis process of building muscle. And leucine, the curve shifts with age. And so you need even more complete proteins to even just maintain your muscle as you get older. That's why so many of us, as we get older, we lose muscle and sarcopenia happens. And so muscle, you know, I look at it as the muscle I have today, the more I could build now is like a down payment on my future so that won't be frail and, you know, in a wheelchair when I'm old. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a good way to look at it. And extended fasting will make you lose some lean mass. It doesn't mean you can't build it back.
Right.
But you will lose some.
So what about the cellular repair? Because I've done 100 hours. That's the longest fast I've ever done. But my research has shown that there's substantial cellular repair that you can get if you go that long without it. So for Alzheimer's specific or cancer specific, I've read that the extended fasting is actually very beneficial for that. So where do you draw your line?
So for me, the only time we ever really recommend or discuss longer fasting, extended fasting, is for cancer.
Okay.
Because cancer, an anabolic disease, it wants to grow and it's all about growth. And when you put it in that state of totally catabolism, like you're not, you know, there's no food coming in, there's no, it can be helpful, I think, for cancer for sure. I'm not sure how helpful it is for Alzheimer's. Again, in the context of, so let me back up and we, you know, autophagy is that cellular repair, right?
Yep.
Autophagy is the process of the body to break down cells into their components and then rebuild new cells that are younger, healthier, et cetera. So it takes, you know, kind of damaged or old cells and rebuilds them. But here's the thing. Yossi Yimenira, the man who won the Nobel Prize for autophagy, he estimates that we turn over all of our protein cells every 4 months or so. That's people eating a typical diet. That's without any fasting. That's without... So, you know, our body is doing repair all the time.
Okay.
And actually, if you look at autophagy markers, the thing that raises autophagy as much or even more than extended fasting is strength training.
which I really recommend to everybody.
Exactly. And that, yeah. So if you really want to ramp up autophagy, oh, and maintain and build lean mass, which is so strong, important for your strength and longevity, strength training is the key. Okay. And that's kind of where we land on that whole spectrum.
So I will say when we had my mom, we did just 16-8 intermittent fasting with her and saw major, major improvements. But since then I've met fasting coaches and done a lot of research on it. So I really wanted, because you guys are kind of my heart and soul on research, where I just trust you so much. So I really kind of, I wanted to hear your take on that. So thank you.
Yeah. And you know, for the vast majority of other things outside of cancer, what we would do instead is a protein sparing modified fast. And what that is, we used to call them pure protein days, which I think is a better name. It's basically little to no carbs, maybe 30 grams of fat, and then you still hit your protein goal for the day, whether that's, you know, we base that on your lean mass, how much muscle you have to maintain. So say, for example, 100 grams of protein. And what that does is it mimics a fast in the energy side. So things like diabetes, weight loss, you know, many, many things, you're getting a lot of the benefits, mm-hmm. but you're maintaining your muscle and still getting those vitamins and minerals, amino acids. Yeah. So that's what we would do instead.
I have to say those pure protein days can be really hard to hit protein goals. Eating that much lean protein, it's really hard to hit 100 grams of protein in a day.
But it also shows lean. The power of it, right?
It does.
Because if you know, a pure protein day is actually like 700-800 calories.
Yeah.
And people say this all the time. I can't eat all the food.
Hard to eat.
Right? So it's like, you know, think about that in the context of the American diet where you're eating 3,000 calories and you're hungry all the time. Right. So that's how powerful it is for weight loss.
Oh, I'm such a huge proponent for protein. So before we jump into the whole carnivore side of things, because I really want to talk about that. I know that's you specifically are a huge expert on carnivore. You've said standard American diet, and that is a huge like trigger word for me, for lack of a better term, because it's just, I mean, it's sad, literally, standard American diet. And I was raised on it. Most of us were raised on it. I'm a child of the 80s, born in the 70s, grew up in the 80s, and barbecue potato chips and Little Debbie snacks were my babysitters because I was a latchkey kid, and TV dinners and you name it. And so it was well into my 30s before I started studying nutrition. And then, of course, when my family started getting sick, when I started looking at keto, I jumped on the Atkins bandwagon in the 90s. Had no clue what I was doing, never read the book, just, you know, followed everybody else and did it wrong. But standard American diet is just so tragic to me. And when people are transitioning from standard American diet to a keto diet, specifically with food addiction, because I fall in that category as well, it can be really challenging to get away from the sweets. And I know I have read some studies now on especially the non-nutritive sweeteners actually creating a higher insulin resistance than sugar can for a lengthier period of time. It'll actually, have you seen these studies? Have you heard about them? When you're transitioning, how would you recommend somebody transition and stay away from things that would trigger them? Because anything touching your tongue can trigger a sweet craving that can blow it all.
Well, yes. So there, I would break this into two parts. First, I mean, we can maybe talk, or you can send me the studies to talk about.
Yeah, gladly.
Because that's not been our experience at all.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we've always had people that, you know, so again, I'm trying to break this into two parts here. From the addictive side, yes, that is a huge factor. And so many people that if they really have that kind of sugar addiction and eating disorder type of an issue with when it comes to that, cutting all sweeteners is a very good idea. Okay. Going all the way to carnivore might be a great idea just to kind of set things. And so, you know, for those people, they need, that's, you know, like our 30-day ketogenic cleanse, which was written, 8 years ago. There's no sweeteners in those meal plans, you know,
right.
And that was part of the reason we're trying to detox and get people off of all that stuff. Right. And so, you know, that's that group. I totally get it. I would say, you know, there's definitely a group of people though that also maybe they don't have that extreme of an issue where they can have it. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have it, they might grab the sugar filled one instead, you know, the temptation.
Yeah.
And so if they have, something with a natural sweetener like stevia or, you know, allulose, erythritol, monk fruit, those are the main ones that we recommend. Mm-hmm. If you have something like that on hand, you're going to grab that instead of the sugar filled one. Yeah. So at least, you know, you didn't go off the rails, right? So in that case, I think they're applicable and I think they're helpful. Now, as far as the claims about causing insulin resistance, I know that there's a cephalic response to a sweet taste that you may have some rise in insulin, which is claimed by some of these studies. I've seen studies that claim the opposite, that there's no rise. But even if there was, just because insulin went up a little bit, if anything, to prove that point, you eat the natural sweetener. And if it's zero calories and insulin does go up, what's going to happen? Your blood sugar is going to go down, right? Because no calories came in, but suddenly your insulin went up. So your blood sugar should take a dive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've had people with CGMs, diabetics, type 1 diabetics, and other people try this. And the vast majority of the time, there's no change in their blood sugar. Sweetener, right? So that means insulin didn't significantly go up.
Okay.
And this also comes back to another sticking point of mine, and I don't know how far we want to get the weeds in the science of this, but
I'll go as far as you want.
It's referring to just insulin in general.
Okay.
And the role of insulin. Okay. Insulin, yes, it's a storage hormone, but it's much more than that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just store fat and store carbs. I think of it more of like a thermostat. Okay. A thermostat is going to fine-tune and adjust the temperature of your house, right? In your body, the insulin is like the thermostat for the supply of fuel in the blood. So the blood, the body does not like any fuel being too high in the blood. Too much alcohol in the blood, it could kill you. Mm-hmm. Too much sugar in the blood can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Much fat in the blood could kill you if you have super high triglycerides, right?
Yep.
So these are all dangerous situations. The body doesn't want that. And guess how much fuel is in your blood right now, you and I sitting here at rest? It's like 80-100 calories of total energy in the blood.
Okay.
So that's, you know, 4 to 5 grams of glucose.
Yep.
That's, you know, 16 calories. Mm-hmm. That's all the pre-fatty acids. That's all the ketones. That's all the fuel that's sitting in your blood right now, right? So you eat a meal of 500, 800 calories, you know, whatever it might be. That's a lot of fuel coming into the blood when you're if you're not running a marathon, you're sitting on the couch still at, you know, once like 80 calories in their blood. So the insulin is like this thermostat that says, well, fuel's coming in. Let's crank that fuel out of the blood and put it in storage. And guess what happens on the other side too? You work out. And this is people are starting to realize this too. You do like a HIIT workout or something and you're wearing a CGM. Guess what happens? Your blood sugar
shoots up
big time. Why? Because insulin went down. It said, hey, I've got to let the floodgates open here and I've got to let all this fuel into the bloodstream. And because you need it, you're doing this crazy intense workout. So more fat, more ketones, more glucose in the blood. And so it's a thermostat, right? It's like, okay, how much energy do I need right now? I'm going to adjust based on how much demand there is for energy. Mm-hmm. And to keep that blood in a tight window of fuel that is appropriate for the time. So in that context, if you did eat a zero calorie sweetener and insulin went up a little bit and again came back down, you didn't eat any fat, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's no fat to store. So if you didn't, you know, your body can't store fat you didn't eat. So the concept of, you know, insulin going up a bit from a sweetener is kind of silly in the context of it's not going to make you store fat because insulin went up a little bit. There's no fat there, right? If the only possible thing, if it did do that, would be if glucose dipped and now you got a little hungry because, you know, glucose went down.
Okay.
That would be, you know, but again, you can't eat, your body can't store fat you didn't eat.
No, I understand that. I just think of it from the perspective of insulin resistance being the real cause for diabetes and Alzheimer's.
And so let's dive into that one more step. Right?
Yeah.
Somebody eating this way, eating low carb, and we have data on this, right?
Yeah.
I got a whole presentation I'm developing on this for in Tennessee later this year. So
pay attention, everyone.
So basically, if you think of insulin, insulin is, again, this thermostat, right?
Okay.
And yeah, spikes in insulin that happen when you eat is going to happen with anything you eat. I mean, people think that it doesn't change with fat. Insulin does go up when you eat fat. Not as much as carbs, not as much as protein.
Sure.
But it goes up because you need
calories.
To.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if it didn't, and you ate, you know, 50 grams of fat in that meal, and it sat in the bloodstream, you'd have triglycerides of 5,000. Nobody wants that.
Yeah.
So it needs to store it off. It needs to get rid of it out of the blood, right? And then use it later. And so if you look at insulin, there's basal insulin, which is your fasting insulin level.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's spikes in insulin with meals, right?
Or right.
Activity, like exercise, there'd be a negative spike, right? Yeah. It'd go down. So fasting insulin, if you look at how much that is over the course of a day, it's about 85% of your insulin needs for your body over the course of the day. The little spikes when you eat is like 15% of the insulin that your body's putting out all day long.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think of it in that context as well, the fasting insulin is the one you really want to worry about, right? That's 85% of the insulin that's going out all day long. And if it's elevated all day long, you want that down. And,
right.
And shrinking the fat cells, if you're diabetic, losing body fat, is going to bring down that insulin, the fasting insulin, and produce way less insulin all day long. Even if compared to somebody with the high fasting insulin and zero spikes when you eat, it's still going to be way more insulin than the guy who brings his fasting insulin level down and maybe has some spikes when they eat.
Okay. Wow. That cleared that up. I'm so glad I asked you that question. I didn't mean to dive into such an insulin, but I'm really glad I did. I hope that that was okay.
But you think about it, I mean, it just makes sense. Like
it does, but it's so scientific. It just is hard to.
If insulin is you don't want chronically elevated insulin.
Right. Absolutely.
So that's what's causing a lot of these issues, right? Or maybe on the other side, if the fat cells it's the result of the issues.
Sure.
But you know, especially with the brain, brain and Alzheimer's and these type of issues, you want to bring that insulin down. You want to enable more ketones to be made and help the brain out. Fasting insulin is the one you want to bring down, and that's what you want to shoot for.
Okay. So the bigger thing would be to get tested for your fasting insulin, which obviously
a good step for sure. Everybody should know that. I think
a good starting point. Yeah. Okay. So let's dive into carnivore then, because as someone who has both the genetic variants for Alzheimer's, I have read that eating too much red meat. So there's kind of an interesting overlap here. So low vitamin B can elevate homocysteine. Homocysteine can elevate from eating too much red meat. I love red meat and will eat it every single day for every meal that I eat because it's the most nutrient dense food. Like I have your carnivore course taught me so much about red meat and it truly is. I eat chicken some, but realistically red meat is the staple of my diet. But it also makes me nervous when I think about what that can do if homocysteine is really something to worry about. And I've read the Alzheimer's anecdote, and I still really didn't get the answer to my question. So I kind of wanted to see if you would touch on this, because I would love to promote carnivore more for people who are preventing and not necessarily trying to reverse Alzheimer's or diabetes, because I just think that carnivore is just the way we should eat. And your science on I want you to give yourself a plug for your courses before we get off this call, but your science behind vegetables and my own personal experience, I can't digest vegetables properly. Every time I try a vegetable again, it's not pretty. Yeah. So I just find that I'm much better off when I stick to carnivore. And I believe that there are a lot of people out there who would find that same result but I do get nervous about homocysteine where Alzheimer's is concerned. Do you have knowledge around that that you can share?
Well, I don't have a ton of knowledge or studies around homocysteine. Okay. Maybe, you know, that's something we can follow up on later.
I would love to, yeah.
Share and whatnot. What I do know is that, you know, primarily it's a type 3 diabetes. It's insulin resistance of the brain. So you want to reverse the insulin resistance and at the same time supply, and I'm talking in the, you know, once you have it context, sure. Provide another fuel that'll help the brain fuel itself other mm-hmm. than glucose. And what other fuel is there for the brain other than glucose? Okay. Ketones.
Yeah.
And in that context as well, you know, even, you know, exogenous ketones, supplements, yeah. You know, anything you can to get that yeah. brain its fuel, it, you know, go for it because that's only going to help. In a prevention standpoint, I just look at it as this, to me, the same way as I look at prevention of type 2 diabetes, in that you don't want to go down that metabolic syndrome path, right? And how do you do that? You don't let it happen with diet, right? Mm-hmm. You prevent, you know, the big problem with type 2 diabetes is that you're storing too much fat and filling your fat cells. How does that primarily happen in the standard American diet? There's something called oxidative priority where you displace other fuels with higher priority fuels.
Right. And
basically in reverse order of storage capacity, where things you have a lot of storage capacity for, fat, it worries about those last because you can store off a lot of calories and worry about the ones you can't store as well, like alcohol. Alcohol, there's no place in the body to store alcohol. Mm-hmm. So the body has to burn that first. So if you have alcohol coming in with some carbs and some fat, guess what? Carbs and fat are going to get stored away while it burns off this alcohol because it has to. Can't store it. The next one is carbs because there's some storage capacity, but in reality, it's not a lot. I mean, you've got like maybe 2,000 calories in your muscle, but guess what? The muscle glycogen is only burned through an intense exercise. Like you go on a brisk hour-long walk, you didn't touch the muscle glycogen hardly at all. It's got to be like a sprint, a lot, you know, HIIT workout, really intense to start tapping that muscle glycogen. So then you really only get like 400 calories in the liver. That's like it. And so the body doesn't have a lot of storage, so it's got to burn that carbs off next as the next priority. Well, that kind of leaves fat, you know, right? So when the carbs are high, and there's been studies that have shown this, they actually mark the, see where the fat is going, see where the carbs are going. They radio mark, you know, the molecules. Mm-hmm. And when carbs are higher, fat gets displaced and stored more. When the carbs go down, you use more fat. It's just, displacing. And so in a lot of people think that you're getting fat from the sugar, mm-hmm. like the carbs are turning into fat in the body, which is a pathway. And sure. if you eat a very large excess of carbohydrates, it can be turned into fat. But primarily, it's the carbs displacing the fat you're eating too, and just storing all that fat away because you're burning these carbs. And so all the fat just goes straight into storage. And so that's where most of the fat on the body actually comes from.
Okay.
But in that context, again, back bringing it back to, you know, diabetes, cut the carbs down. So A, you're not displacing all the fat, and you're not spiking insulin all the time and keep creating more hunger. So you're overeating, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Those, if you put all that in order, you'll be on the right path to preventing type 2 diabetes. And I also think type 3 diabetes, which is Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the context of carnivore, you know, for me personally, we look at keto and carnivore a little bit based on, mostly based on what is your why. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we talked about this in our carnivore cookbook. One of the first things we said is, what's your why? Why do you want to do carnivore? And that'll change how you do it or whether you even do it at all. And if it's Alzheimer's, if it's bipolar, if it's autoimmune disorders, these are good reasons to try carnivore because you're removing plants from the diet. And we look at carnivore as just a subset of keto. It's keto without the plants.
Yeah.
And you're removing plants. And with removal of the plants, you're removing a lot of anti-nutrients, a lot of basically toxins to the body, right? And when you're metabolically having dysfunction, whether it's type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, autoimmune disorders, whatever it might be, myself, Lyme disease and SIRS and autoimmune disorders that resulted from that. Getting rid of that extra load on your body to detox these compounds is a good idea. And for me, it lowers my pain when I eat carnivore versus keto. I can, you know, if I get too much plant in my diet, I'll see my pain go up. And I think it's because, you know, when you have this inflammation in the body and this, your immune system's in high gear all the time, like it is with me, and then you add another load on that to detox all these oxalates and glucosinolates and, you know, lectins and all these compounds in plants that your body doesn't want, it doesn't need, it has to detox them. So it adds even more to the detoxing and load and inflammation in the body, and it just causes more pain and issues. And people see this with bipolar and other brain issues as well. If they, like Amber O'Hearn is somebody who's been carnivore for many, many years, and she does for her bipolar. And even if she gets too much like spices and things, even in her diet, she'll see symptoms start to come back. So, you know, it can be really important to stay real strict in those situations. And so I do think it's applicable for Alzheimer's for sure. And, you know, just because not only is it addressing the fuel side, cutting the carbs out and, you know, all that, but also possible issues with plants and anti-nutrients.
Yeah. If you look at some of the books that some of these neurologists like Dr. Dale Bredesen have put out regarding Alzheimer's, inflammation is one of the key things they talk about. Yeah. And so then I think you answered my question, but I'm just going to go ahead and say, if you had to suggest a type of diet for someone, would you suggest keto or carnivore for Alzheimer's?
If they've got a strong family history, if they've got, I personally would probably go carnivore. Yeah.
Okay.
I've been carnivore for the last like 6 years, due to my, you know, Lyme disease and issues with that. I go back to our ancestors, you know, when you look at human history and you say, okay, what did our ancestors eat? And I'm not talking 100 years ago when, you know, I'm talking 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 years ago, mm-hmm. when we became human in the first place, mm-hmm. right? Because there was a period of time around 50,000, 100,000 years ago where we separated and we grew these big brains and our guts shrank, right? And why did that happen, right? So why did that happen? There's been so many studies on this now about it's anthropological evidence of the bone collagen in these fossils, right? So they take fossils of early humans and Neanderthals, mm-hmm. and they look at the collagen that's in the bone. And from that, they look at the nitrogen content, and they can tell, based on those nitrogen groups, what proteins that animal ate or that person ate.
I just saw a podcast on this the other day. It was fascinating.
Yeah. And so they do all the different animals of that period, like woolly mammoths, whatever. And then they do the humans, the early humans and the Neanderthals. And then they plot them out and they say, okay, what proteins are they getting? Are they eating? Are they eating plant proteins? Are they eating animal proteins? And if they're eating animal proteins, they can even tell what kind of animals they're eating. Like they break it all down, and study after study after study has shown that these early humans were apex carnivores. They ate pretty much nothing but large ruminant animals. The woolly mammoths, rhinos of that period, like that's what they were eating all the time. And they apex means they were the most dominant carnivore. And when you look at the spectrum on the charts, they're above lions, they're above hyenas as far as apex carnivores, right? Things that we think of as very much a carnivore, right? They don't eat plants, right?
Yeah.
So if we grew these big brains and our guts shrank because we were eating carnivore, doesn't that kind of say that humans should be eating that way most of the time, right? And so that's the way I look at it. And for us, it's more of a preference. Like if you don't have these metabolic disorders, Alzheimer's, autoimmune disorders, and you want to include some plants, low-carb vegetables, whatever in your diet, great, go for it. Mm-hmm. But if you do have these conditions, it may be a good idea to go to carnivore.
Yeah. I can't get my husband to switch over, so we still do a little more mushrooms, things like that. But I'm primarily carnivore. I had another question for you, and I just lost it. Oh, one of the things in the course that you talk about, just talking about the gut, is how acidic our stomachs are, how we are designed to actually digest protein over the plants. And I know how toxic the plants are. I don't want to dive too much into that because I'd really rather somebody take your course. But just touch on that just really quickly, just to kind of drive that point home about how acidic we actually are to be able to process that. Because I think that's what the whole vegan movement for 50 years has been trying to talk about, is how we're not supposed to eat meat because we're not designed to digest it. And it's the actual opposite of that.
Completely opposite. And if you can break every piece down, actually on our YouTube channel, Maria Emmerich, I have a case for carnivore.
Okay.
Did at KetoCon a few years ago.
And I'll find it and link it.
Breaks down each thing, like the digestive tract, how long our colon is, our small intestine and big intestine compare, and cecum, and how it's completely changed to be prioritizing proteins compared to other primates and things. But then the stomach pH is another huge indicator that what we should be eating, right? If your stomach pH, the lower the pH number, the more acidic your stomach is. And the stomach pH of animals that are clearly, plant eaters, they're herbivores, there's, deer and these kind of things, they're like 5 to 6 stomach pH, almost neutral, like very lightly acidic. You start looking at omnivores that clearly eat both in nature, and they're like 4 to 5. You start looking at carnivores, and they're usually like 2 to 3 is stomach pH. Because again, you're getting down. Part of the reason is that in nature, the meat you're eating isn't always the freshest, right? You know, the lion isn't going to be able to refrigerate that. So it's got to be able to, they usually eat it within a couple of days, but it's already turning. So they get really acidic stomach to deal with that, right? You look at things that are scavengers. Now you're talking about animals that they're definitely eating turned meat, and their stomach pH is usually like 1.5 to 2. Right, or 1 to 2 is usually kind of the range of their stomach pH. Humans, our stomach pH is 1.5.
There you go. So,
not only are we designed to eat meat, we're able to eat meat that's turning. And why might that have been? Let's go back to what we just talked about. You have these early humans that are eating large ruminant animals, right? So think about a woolly mammoth, way bigger than an elephant, right? And they're killing these and eating them for weeks. They might have some primitive preservation techniques, whether it's smoking or whatever, but they didn't have much to preserve these. And so you think about one huge woolly mammoth that could feed a tribe of 30 of these early humans for a month, right? And that's what they're eating. So they had a very that's why we have a 1.5 stomach pH. And there's so much evidence of this. Like, There was just a pit that was found in Europe that had like hundreds of woolly mammoth bones in it, hundreds of animals. Well, what the early humans did is they dug a pit, and then they just chased the woolly mammoths towards the pit. And when one fell in, they start eating on it, right? That's one of their early hunting techniques. And, there's cave paintings or whatever of, hunting woolly mammoths. There's not salads or plants, right?
Yeah.
So, the evidence is clear to me that, we were primarily carnivores and we were opportunistic omnivores, in that you found some berries or something, yeah, you're going to eat them, right? Mm-hmm. If you come across them. But in nature, even now, we found some wild strawberries at my father-in-law's cabin, and we're picking them, everything we could find we picked, and it filled up like the palm of my hand.
Yeah.
Right? Like the size of one hybridized strawberry that you get at the store today.
Oh my gosh.
So, and that's a whole nother topic of how we bred these things to be less and less nutrients and more sugar.
Yeah.
We are carnivores by our design. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this interview with me today. I'm so excited to get it posted next weekend. Before we go, I would love for you to tell everybody where they can find you. I also just signed up got my ticket off of your Instagram page for the Carnivore Summit coming up. So awesome. Please tell everybody about that. And then I will make sure to link everything in the comment or in the description below.
Thank you.
Where can we find you?
Well, thank you for having me on. And it's the easiest way is ketomaria.com.
Okay.
I made this landing page. You can get to our blog. You can get to where we sell our eBooks and support our courses on keto-adapted.com. And then at the bottom, we have links to all of our social media. So it's like one place to get to everything. There's also that Judy Cho was nice enough to include me in her Carnivore Summit that's coming up. Mm-hmm. There's a link on my social media channels to get to that if you like.
Perfect.
It should be pretty cool.
All right. Well, I thank you. I'm going to send you those studies too, because I just in the background would love to hear your feedback on it.
Absolutely. I'm always willing to learn and study and understand. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have a feeling you're going to put me in my place, but I'll take it.
Devil's always in the details of the studies.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, that's the thing though. I'm always looking for the information to pass along, but when it comes to the scientific stuff, I read it and I really try to understand it, but I have to dig so deep. And unfortunately, right now I don't have time to go look up what all these things mean.
I mean, there's just a recent one that keto causes increased whatever, some disease disorder. You go in and actually read the study. Their low carb group that they then called keto group was 30% of calories from carbs.
You did. I think you guys did a video on that, didn't you?
Yeah, it's like 150, maybe as much as 200 grams of carbs a day. That's not even low carb.
No.
To call that keto is just not. It's you're lying.
Yeah. Well, that's my biggest problem with all the keto products that you can buy in the store too.
Yeah.
Oh, just get back in the kitchen, everybody.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. I know it's Saturday. Go have a wonderful day and I will be in touch.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, I hope that you enjoyed that interview. I can tell you I had the most informative time talking with him and listening to his knowledge. There are things that I know you saw in that interview. I thought I knew a lot more than I did. And he debunks a couple of things, especially around fasting, which I really enjoyed hearing. And I have a fasting coach friends who I love them and I love their mission. And I agree with a lot of their fasting ideals, but it was really good to hear Craig's ideas around fasting, especially when it comes to brain health. It really aligned with a lot of the neurologists that I follow and their books that I read. So that was very, very good. If you have any questions for Craig, I encourage you to leave them in the comment section below and I will gladly reach out to him and ask him those questions for you, or reach out to him yourself. Go follow him on all of his social medias. They are in the description below. Join that Carnivore Summit. That is also in the description below. And if you have any questions for me specifically, I am here for you. Thank you so much for tuning in and I'll see you next week. Bye.